this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for this next hour, they're going to be the views of William Greig, who is formerly one of the chief reporters, the senior editor of the New American Magazine, certainly one of the outstanding conservative publications in the country. And today, of course, he does talk radio. He writes profusely. In fact, we go to his blog almost on a daily basis. Fascinating material there, and of course he has a new book we hope to have out here in a week or so. We're going into the background of the move of America away from being a free society towards a society where everybody is monitored and watched, and of course we're losing our freedom in the name of fighting the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's living in a cave in Pakistan and wants to take away our freedom. And that's why we've got to take away the freedom of the American people, so that Osama bin Laden doesn't take away our freedom, or that seems to be the rationale. Well, with that as a background, hi William, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me again.
Well, it's always a pleasure to really have you, a privilege. So what are we going to talk about tonight?
I think one of the things we're going to have to talk about is the subject that we've not yet exhausted, but spoken of at great length and in great detail, and that's the ongoing collapse of the dollar and the unwinding of our debt-based economy. I think really there is a more important story than that, because everything that our government does and has done for quite some time, it does on credit, which is another way of saying on debt, and those debts now are coming home to roost in a really visible and tangible way. Just a couple of days ago, as a matter of fact, it was yesterday, there was a story in the Boston Globe talking about the fact that companies from Europe, Asia, and Canada are taking advantage of the weaker dollar to buy their U.S. counterparts at a record pace. It quotes Donald Klepper Smith, who's the chief economist at DataCore Partners, saying, "We could be looking at the world's largest tag sale if we continue to see declines in the dollar." The thing that I find really interesting about this is that this is a really good illustration of what could be considered voting with your feet, if you will. People are rejecting the dollar as the world's dominant currency, the reserve currency for the world, in spite of the fact that it's been the only game in town since the end of the Bretton Woods system and Nixon taking the United States and pretty much the world off the gold standard back in the 1970s and establishing what you'd call the petrodollar. That's something we've discussed before, Dr. Stan, the fact that this entente between Washington and Riyadh is what has propped up the dollar. The fact that the Saudis are charging dollars exclusively for their oil and thereby keeping the dollar up and providing the basis for the dollar being accepted as the reserve currency, in spite of the fact that it's a fiat currency backed by nothing, in exchange for a special relationship involving weapon sales, financial aid, and all kinds of other emoluments that end up enriching, among other people, the charming folks who created Al-Qaeda. And the petrodollar now is headed for some very dangerous shoals, just as people in Asia and elsewhere are moving out of the dollar at the same time, and foreign investors now are trying to buy up tangible assets rather than taking dollars.
Oh, I think we're going to be back in just a moment, but certainly we see Russia, for instance, wanting to sell their oil in either rubles or in euros.
Or in euro, yeah.
And, of course, we're seeing other countries beginning to turn to the euro, certainly Iran, Venezuela, and certainly the Arab countries are beginning to move more towards the euro. And, of course, once the dollar ceases to be the reserve currency of the world, all those trillions of dollars that we've exported so we wouldn't have inflation are going to come rushing back into America, and you're going to see an inflationary spiral that's frightening.
Yeah, we're probably going to see something akin to hyperinflation of the sort, not necessarily that you saw in Weimar Germany. That's a possibility. Weimar Germany was no more deeply in debt than we are right now. Of course, in the case of Weimar Germany, you're dealing with the punitive war reparations that were imposed on that country at Versailles. But perhaps along the lines of what we've seen in such countries as Brazil, the worst, I think the most notorious example, obviously, is what's going on in communist-dominated Zimbabwe right now, where you have literally astronomical hyperinflation. But as I mentioned before the break, once again, we have to talk about this petrodollar accord that really has been the foundation for the dollar remaining the world's reserve currency for decades after it was completely decoupled from gold. There was a piece in the Telegraph, London Telegraph, by Ambrose Evans Pritchard. Mr. Evans Pritchard is, I think, one of the most perspicuous commentators about what's going on in American politics, and certainly he knows a great deal about what's going on in high finance. And I interviewed Mr. Evans Pritchard about 10 or 11 years ago. I'm trying to remember exactly when. He had been here in the United States covering the first term of the first term of the late unlamented Bill Clinton presidency in the first year or so of the second term. And Mr. Evans Pritchard was really quite struck by the fact that there were some authoritarian changes taking place in the American political system even then. But he's gone back across the Atlantic now, and he's writing for the Telegraph of London, and he had a piece in today's edition of the London Telegraph talking about how Vietnam and Qatar, I don't know exactly how to pronounce the name of that emirate. It could be Gutter, it could be Guitar. I'll call it Qatar. In any case, it's one of the oil-rich Gulf emirates, obviously, or kingdoms, sheikdoms, fiefdoms, however you want to describe it. It's an oil-rich Persian Gulf Arab kingdom. And both Vietnam and Qatar are moving away from the dollar. The Saigon Times has reported that the State Bank of Vietnam is abandoning the attempt to hold down the Vietnamese currency through heavy purchases of dollars. It's gotten to be this bad. I mean, we fought a war, you'll recall, with Vietnam that ended on very unfavorable terms in 1975. And now Washington has been relying upon Vietnam, as well as China and Saudi Arabia and Russia, to prop up the value of the dollar. I mean, that really puts us in an interesting position where the putative world hyperpower is a mendicant seeking for its former enemies, including a tin pot country like Vietnam, communist Vietnam, to be purchasing dollars through treasury bills and other instruments in order to help keep the value of the dollar up when compared to the currency, the fiat currency issued by that communist country and other countries.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here, Will. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William is simply saying that right now we're relying upon Vietnam and communist China and Russia to help us stabilize our currency. The American government is having to borrow $2 to $3 billion every day to pay its debts. We do not have reserves, massive reserves, like both Russia and China do. We're relying on these other countries. I said they were the most powerful nation in the world militarily, but financially we're the largest debtor nation the world has ever seen. And certainly Vietnam, apparently, is beginning, and Qatar, one of the Arab emirates nations, they have announced they're going to begin to abandon the dollar as the standard, as the reserve currency, and try to find other things. They're going to, Vietnam certainly is going to let the value of their currency rise because it's too expensive to try to keep it tied to the American dollar. China wants to come into America, and they've got all these dollars. They want to buy a part of our defense industry, and there's tremendous opposition to that. Well, if you've got all these dollars and you can't spend them, why bother to hold the dollars? So there's going to be a lot of problems as China comes in to trying to buy up our infrastructure. They hold probably somewhere close to $1 trillion in American dollars, and of course that's their money. They have the right to buy with it. Only we won't let them buy things. So pick up the story there, will you?
Yeah. One of the really unfortunate things here, and this is, of course, entirely true. It is absolutely true. It's in the Bible. I'd take that as being foundational bedrock truth. And there is a proverb that informs us that the borrower is always slave to the lender. And so when we have been looking to countries like China and Saudi Arabia and Russia, and then lesser unpleasant governments like that of Vietnam, to lend us the money to maintain the operating expenses of this huge overgrown government that rules us, we've been putting ourselves in bondage to foreign interests. And many of these foreign interests are ruled by governments that are at least as bad as our own. And the thing about the Vietnamese move here, where they're talking about moving out of the dollar, or moving away from the dollar, decoupling their currency from the dollar because it's just too expensive to maintain their standard of living as a way of keeping the dollar artificially propped up, that's seen as a bellwether for what might happen in Asia. Asia, of course, is dominated by China right now, China and India. China from the, if you will, factory floor perspective, and India from the high-tech or information technology perspective. They're the dominant powers in Asia, but there are also countries such as South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Thailand, that are all very much involved in manufacturing, and all of them have been out, their governments have been out in the currency markets propping up the dollar. When Vietnam moves away from the dollar peg, that's seen as what you might consider to be the first pebbles of an approaching avalanche. And there are reasons to believe, and Mr. Evans Pritchard of the Telegraph of London has been one of the people who've been bird-dogging this issue very assiduously. There are reasons to believe that China is already quietly unloading some of its treasury notes, its securities. This, of course, as you mentioned, Dr. Stan, out buying up American companies and defense-related industries and buying up infrastructure from states and municipalities in this country. And that's, of course, an entirely logical development. If you're holding an appreciating asset, you want to get rid of it before it loses its value entirely. And now, of course, that Bernanke has fired up the helicopters and starting to drop bundles of cash out of them to try to avoid a necessary contraction. There has to be a contraction. They have to shake the excess capacity out of the productive element of the economy. They have to go out and clean up the clusters of errors, as von Mises would put it. They're trying to avoid that, of course. They want to defer the day of reckoning, and in order to do that, they're devaluing the dollar. And that, of course, is helping to accelerate this avalanche that Vietnam represents here. The case of Qatar is really quite interesting as well, because, once again, you're dealing with a Gulf state that is involved in energy. It exports a lot of oil, also a lot of natural gas. Has announced that it has cut the dollar holdings of its sovereign wealth fund. That's a subject we talked about before, Dr. Stan.
Well, maybe you could just tell our listeners quickly what the sovereign wealth fund is, because they may not be acquainted with that,
yes,
that term.
Sovereign wealth fund, this is something that has been discussed in The Economist of London at some great length and detail, is an investment fund that is controlled by a national state, a national government. Rather than being a private investment undertaking, a private investment group, or some other kind of a business arrangement that would go out and buy up assets using privately raised capital, it is an investment instrument that is wholly owned by a national government. By and large, the governments that have sovereign, what they call the sovereign wealth funds, are oil exporting companies, because naturally, they have a whole lot of cash reserve, foreign exchange reserve, that is built up by the sale of energy, particularly now that the price of gas and natural gas and oil have gone up. They have this huge accumulation, huge hordes of dollars. They create a sovereign wealth fund for the purpose of going out and buying infrastructure or buying other assets, companies, productive plant, things of that sort in the United States and elsewhere. In Germany, I think, if I remember correctly, I think Merkel, the Prime Minister of Germany, has actually taken steps to ban the role of sovereign wealth funds in acquiring assets within the country of Germany. She's not nationalized those assets, but her government has forbidden foreign sovereign wealth funds from coming in and buying up those assets. Well, here in the United States, we don't have that type of an arrangement. I mean, once again, we're the world's largest beggar, world's largest debtor economy. So when these state-controlled, these government-controlled investment instruments start buying up assets in the United States, by and large, Washington looks very favorably on this, and so do the the debt-strapped and cash-poor states and municipalities that are selling off these assets. But every time you hear about a sovereign wealth fund, that's basically a national government with a whole lot of money looking to buy up assets here in the United States.
In fact, there is some sort of executive order that President George Herbert Walker Bush pushed, mm-hmm. that sort of nationalized our infrastructure so that it could be sold off. And as you know, of course, other countries are buying up the New Jersey Turnpike and the Ohio Turnpike and the Chicago Skyway and, mm-hmm. and a lot of our bridges. And they're all being bought up all across the country by other nations. Certainly the major highway being built is going to through Texas and all the way up into Canada. This 4-football-wide massive highway structure is being built by a Spanish firm.
Yeah.
So foreign countries are coming in and simply buying up the infrastructure of our society and our corporations. Over 25% of our major corporations today are owned by foreign countries, and soon we will be serfs in our own country.
Exactly. Really nasty thing that probably happened with this planned gargantuan continent bisecting highway that has been discussed, the beginning part of which would be the Trans-Texas Corridor, but it's of course something that would be, as you mentioned, a monstrously huge thoroughfare that would be built by this foreign consortium, and which would charge tolls which would enrich this foreign consortium, is that the properties that are going to be accumulated in order to buy this immense highway would be accumulated through eminent domain. And that, of course, brings us back to the Kayla decision of just a few years ago, which vastly expanded the powers of eminent domain in order to enrich commercial enterprises. That's a really interesting thing. The Kayla case involved a federally funded investment group was it Connecticut? I think it was Connecticut. The state of Connecticut, the state of New Hampshire, one of the two. Or was it Delaware? It was one of the states back east. But this was something that was being done by a federally sponsored or federally subsidized investment group. And so you have, in a way, a really good paradigm for what's going on right now with these foreign governments subsidizing the acquisition of properties in the United States for the purpose of their for-profit enterprises. And so what I'm predicting will happen here with respect to the creation of the so-called NAFTA superhighway, which is a sort of nickname that's been attached to this project by critics of the undertaking, is that you're going to see huge tracts of land bought up on probably concessionary terms through eminent domain to enrich a foreign-owned commercial enterprise that would be able to operate this for profit. So it would not only be corporatism, which is a bad system here when it's operated domestically, it would be a form of globalist or transnational corporatism, where the profits would be private, the expenses would be subsidized, the losses would be socialized, and of course the people who would be consumers will have no say in what they'll have to pay in order to use this asset.
And of course this all sort of goes along with that plan of the Earth Charter for equitable mm-hmm. distribution of wealth between nations. And so this
yeah.
is a way how we will redistribute the wealth of the American people to other countries, and people don't understand there is a plan. It's up there on the Internet. You can pull it down, or we'll be glad to send you a copy of it, written by three of the fabulously wealthy people. That's the Earth Charter. Read it, understand that it deals with a new spirituality, but a new economic system. And, of course, this goes right along with what William is talking about. Go ahead.
With respect to these infrastructure purchases, the appeal for state and local governments, this is something I think we may have discussed before. I've certainly written about this. The appeal for cash-poor municipalities and state governments is that they have a sudden infusion of cash that they can use to lavish on their preferred constituencies. You know, teachers' unions, one really good example, other politically connected interest groups. And so the idea is that it's basically found money. It's something that will relieve the burden on the poor, overstressed taxpayer. The problem is, so once that initial infusion is gone, you're going to have a larger group of tax-fed parasites. You're going to have pretty much the same population, the same universe of taxpayers. So what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to raise taxes And at the same time, people are going to have to pay to use the infrastructure they had previously not had to pay for, apart from paying local taxes. They're going to get a double whammy.
They'd already bought and paid for it with the taxes. Now they've sold it off so they can use that money to buy the support of the teachers or other public employees unions. And but, of course, what do you do next year? You've sold it off this year. Where's the money going to come from next year to lavish onto the public employees and government employees? Well, we'll sell off something more, but what happens when there's nothing left to sell off? And this is just where we're headed, ladies and gentlemen. It's not happening by accident. It's happening, I believe, intentionally. And, of course, it's a pretty bleak future.
Actually, it's a pretty bleak present, because what's happening in a lot of these communities, you actually go out and do a fairly uncomplicated search and find stories of the sort. I have, and I think a number of...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mined supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
sites time after time where police will go into somebody's home without a warrant, without a legal warrant. They'll search the home. They'll find $1,000, $1,500 that the people have. That's their own money. They're not drug dealers, and they'll just take the money, and they won't give it back again. I mean, after all, why do you need $1,500 at your home? If you have $1,500, you must be a drug dealer, despite the fact that we didn't find any drugs, despite the fact we didn't have a warrant to search your home. We've got your money. You complain, we won't let you out of prison. So then they let them go, but they never get their money back. And that, to me, is really a frightening thing to contemplate. I really enjoyed those articles on your blog spot.
Oh, I appreciate that. Well, it's really frustrating, and I know that a lot of people, we have mutual friends, you and I, in law enforcement or who have served in law enforcement and are now retired, who are just as mortified as we are, if not more so, because these people went into police work out of a desire to protect the rights of the innocent, not to trample on them. And I know that one very good friend of mine, he's a mutual friend, Kevin Beerley, has described on many occasions how he enlisted in the LAPD because he didn't like bullies. He wanted to do something about bullies. You know, people who would use their capacity for violence to intimidate others or to steal from them or to brutalize them or work their evil will upon them in some way. And unfortunately, there's been a cultural change here where that's the personality type that's achieving a certain saliency in police work today, and that's a terrible tragedy on many accounts, not the least of which is the fact that I'm old enough, I'm not terribly old, I'm 44, I'm old enough to remember when people looked upon the police with a certain sense of gratitude and respect, and you felt a certain confidence and security when you were in the presence of a police officer. You were certain that you were dealing with somebody who was going to be helpful, somebody who would look to your interests, and if you were being threatened by one of the bullies Kevin described, that you could recur to a police officer for help. And nowadays, of course, it's gotten to the point where you make eye contact with a police officer, chances are the police officer is going to look on you as a threat. That's a cultural change, which has happened, I think, pretty much in the last 20 years or so, and it really gathered momentum after 1994 with the Omnibus Crime Bill, where the Clinton administration was suddenly doling out hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions of dollars for the purpose of recruiting police officers from those social strata which tend to produce the types of bullies who otherwise would be on the other end of the law. And unfortunately, this last week or so, both on my blog, Pro Libertate, and on the radio commentaries I've been doing, I've had a steady stream of horrible, heartrending stories of really cynical police abuse. The story that you referred to earlier about this ghastly crime wave in Chicago involving the Special Operations Section, or SOS, it's a street crime unit which was created as a result of the Clinton crime bill back in 1994. They were a gang, literally, a gang of 300 people.
Now, they were police officers.
Yeah, they're police officers. The most conspicuous criminal I mentioned here is a fellow by the name of Jerome Finnegan. He's my age. He applied to become a corrections officer, that is to say a prison guard, in 1984 when he was 21, and he washed out. Now, it really takes a certain breed of cat to fail to qualify to become a prison guard. I mean, that's pretty much the lowest hurdle you can get over in order to get into law enforcement. Somehow he ends up heading up a unit attached to this SOS division in the Chicago Police Department, and he and five or six of his friends would literally grab people off the street and intimidate them, arrest them, hit them up with spurious drug charges, and then find out where their home address was, then go and rob their homes. And then often they would either plant narcotics on site to justify the arrest, or they wouldn't even bother to do that. They'd simply file spurious charges, let somebody cool his heels in jail for a while, and then just pull a no-show when the people were brought up on charges. When there was a formal arraignment hearing, the police simply wouldn't show up, and so they'd have the charges dismissed, and meanwhile, the family, of course, had been out several thousand dollars. This happened time after time. There are hundreds of complaints involving thousands of incidents of this sort in Chicago in the last 10 or 12 years. And it's not gotten any better since then, unfortunately.
And, of course, when your police become criminals, why then what do you do and how do you protect yourself? Chicago's always had this sort of a problem, but probably now more than ever before. Before, there was a ties to the mafia, and now it's just thugs working for the police force, but constantly being defended by the police union. Well, just because there's a few bad apples doesn't mean everybody's bad. Well, of course, when does the police begin to police itself? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, but one of the problems we have is when a society loses its moral foundation, when we teach our young people in school that there is no God, that everything is relative, we're all animals, we simply a person who dies with the most toys is the person who wins, and certainly, well, what's wrong with actually a little crime here and there? After all, you're a police officer. Why shouldn't you be able to benefit when so many people have so much and you have so little and you're risking your lives to defend the public? And we've lost the moral foundation. We need moral people in our police forces. We need people who fear God. And once we remove the fear of God from our people, and specifically from our police and our politicians, then what do we replace it with? And we replace it with absolutely nothing, and we end up with moral anarchy. And that's the direction we're headed today. William, you pick up the story there.
Oh, that's definitely the biggest problem we confront right now, is this all-encompassing sense of cynical materialism, which afflicts both the public at large and that element of the public that ends up working for this congealed instrument of corruption and oppression we call the state. It certainly stands to reason that if you have a public that has become inured to the idea that they can use the government to enrich themselves at the expense of others, the type of people who end up going into what is called public service tend to reflect that. As a matter of fact, they tend to reflect and amplify that characteristic. That's something that not many people appreciate, is that we get pretty much, as a government, sort of a grandiose, exaggerated version of exactly the kind of people we've become. And so when we see people like the head of the Housing and Urban Development Department, Alfonso Jackson, has been accused of influence peddling and bribery involving the post-Hurricane Katrina relief in New Orleans, just to cite one example that's in the headlines right now, literally this evening. Somebody who's unjustly enriching himself through taxpayer subsidy. That's the sort of thing that happens every single day at some level or another, whether you're talking about the type of quotidian welfare fraud that Ronald Reagan made famous with his anecdotes about welfare queens, or if you're talking about the really big welfare queens like Dick Cheney, who made a living getting government subsidies for Halliburton as a defense contractor and as an official contractor for the federal government, also using the Export-Import Bank and the Overseas Private Investment Corporation to underwrite the construction of nuclear plants in China and oil pipelines in Iran, things of that sort.
Hold on, we're going to be back here in just a moment with William Grieg right here at Radio Liberty. All right, Dr. Stan, well, we were just talking about the breakdown of morality within our society, and whether it be the officers in the Chicago police force that had formed a gang they were supposed to be putting down, certainly illegal activity, and they were engaged in illegal activity and simply arresting people on trumped-up charges and stealing their money, and this was literally thousands of people, and this was a unit in the special anti-gang force in Chicago, but we see this in every aspect of life. High government officials, recently a federal district attorney, a federal prosecuting attorney, was arrested. He's a father, coaches the girls' softball team, a pillar of the community, a father of three or four, And, of course, he's arrested after flying to another state so he can have intimate relations with a five-year-old girl. At least he thinks that's what he's going to have. He's actually, of course, been talking to a police informant, pretending to be the girl's mother, and he's paying money for this. I mean, what sort of man would you want in a high federal position prosecuting criminals when he himself is this sort of criminal? I mean, what's happened to the moral foundation? What's happened to the minds of these people who are so perverted, so have no moral foundation at all? We have a real problem in America, and as I said, the biggest problem in America is we're moving towards moral anarchy because we've destroyed this fear of God that once was a very important part of our society. In fact, we do everything to train our children in schools all across America. Mm-hmm. There is no God. We have evolved from a lower form of slime. So the evolution is fact, creation is a fraud, and then we wonder why we have moral anarchy? Go ahead, William.
Well, Dr. Stan, in your research into these ancient Hermetic brotherhoods, I'm sure that you've run into the mythology, or at least the mythologized accounts, of what may be the truth about this historical figure known as Nimrod, the legendary founder of Babylon.
Right.
And if you read Josephus's Antiquities, it talks about the idea that Nimrod had conceived it in his heart to create a society that would be dependent on government and which would be organized on the principle of rejecting God's sovereignty. And he saw no way of doing this. I'm paraphrasing now from the Antiquities of the Jews by Flavius Josephus. He saw no better way of doing this than making everybody dependent upon him and his government. And that's, of course, the sort of a situation we have right now where we pay lip service to God, but with our actions as a society, in the aggregate, by our actions, we bear a very eloquent testimony that our true deity is the state, because it is the state that we look to for support and succor and sustenance. It is the state that we seek to palliate and that we revere and worship and we turn to for protection. Republicans, who tend to advertise themselves as being pious, are even worse at this right now than Democrats, because they're worshiping the state in its pure, unalloyed essence as the entity that kills people and breaks things, because they're very militaristic. There's a place for the military, obviously. I'm not denigrating the military here in its proper subordinate role in our republic. I mean, we have to have a national defense. That's part of the reality of the fallen world that we live in. You know, there are times where, in this fallen, wicked world, it is necessary to defend our rights and our national independence against foreign enemies. And that's why we have a military. It's the only reason we have a military. But unfortunately, there's this disfiguring disproportion in the Republican perception of the world right now, where with one face, these people will talk about the fact that government is deadly and dangerous to liberty, and it should be kept in its constitutional cage, while with their other mouth, their other face, they will say that we have to unshackle the military and let it do whatever it is necessary in order to impose the will of our government on the Iraqis and Iranians and anybody else our government describes as this week's enemy. And you really cannot have a bloodthirsty imperial government abroad and have a republic ruled by law at home. You have to pick one or the other. You have to have a republic that has a Republican, small R Republican foreign policy, or you can have an imperial foreign policy and an increasingly degenerate, despotic, dictatorial government at home. You know, those two things go together. You know, a republic, rule of law, and a non-interventionist foreign policy, that's a package deal. You don't get to change, can't have that a la carte. It all goes together. And, of course, on the Democratic side of the ledger, there's this idea that this individual called Jesus was actually a socialist, social reformer. You know, that's the Democratic caricature of how the state should operate. The idea being that if Jesus were among us today, he would actually support the forcible redistribution of wealth from the productive into the hands of favored clients and constituencies of the government, because he believes in social justice. You know, they don't look upon Jesus Christ as the incarnation of God or the Redeemer made flesh. They don't look upon him as somebody who is our sovereign Lord and Judge. They see him as, you know, basically an avatar of the same values represented by the likes of Cesar Chavez or Vladimir Lenin, you know, that's something that is, of course, centuries old. I mean, the chief conceit of the so-called Enlightenment of the 18th century was the idea that you could deracinate the Christian message of equity and justice and then attach it to a social agenda that would require a big and invasive government. And that's something, of course, that's grown into contemporary so-called liberation theology. That's the regnant form of idolatry on the American left. But on what passes for the conservative end of the American spectrum, it's militarism. Nationalism, which is not the same thing, I hasten to explain, as the belief in national independence. Nationalism is the idea of a strong central government. I mean, that's something that's antithetical to the idea of a constitution of the small United States and Congress assembled. That's not a national arrangement. That's a federal arrangement. Different concept. Don't have time to get into the details. But nationalism is a creation of the 19th century movements in such countries as kingdoms that became countries as Italy and Germany and so forth. And it's really not the same thing at all as what our founders created. And that's the sort of matrix on which the Republican Party has built its form of collectivism, is this militarism abroad, and this with Bush in office, in any case, with a Republican in office, suddenly there's this idea that you simply cannot be a patriot unless you uphold everything that the leader of the executive branch has to say. You know, Bill Clinton was saying the same thing. You can go back and actually listen to the audio clip of a speech he gave at Michigan State University in May of 1995, where he said, "You cannot love your country and hate your government." That's the same message the Republican Party is throwing at us right now by way of its mouthpieces, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity being the most obnoxious and stupidest of that lot. They constantly reiterate Bill Clinton's fundamental message now that a Republican is in office. And just last week, John C. Yoo was a Justice Department official during the first term of the Bush administration. He's the fellow who basically crafted this doctrine of plenipotentiary executive authority, you know, the right supposedly of a president to order the torture of anybody or the permanent detention of anybody he sees fit to have tortured or detained. John C. Yoo has gone so far as to say that the president can order the sexual torture of children if he sees fit to do so. That's how far gone Mr. Yoo, as a movement conservative, is in this abject worship of the national government is embodied in the presidency. But this is what he said last week, and I'm quoting now: "Every subordinate should agree with the president's views, so there is a unified approach to the law." Now, that's the leader principle, you know, Führerprinzip, of course, is the German expression. The idea being that it doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong, the president has thus ordained it. And what's really important is that we're all unified behind the leader. And that, of course, is, once again, 180 degrees out of phase with the idea of checks and balances, where you have three branches of the central government that are intended to keep power diffuse, and where you have people who advise the president for the purpose of making sure that you do not have consolidated power in the hands of a corrupt and unaccountable man. And go back to the Bible once again. In a multitude of counselors there is wisdom, there is safety. I'm paraphrasing this. In the multitude of counselors, there is safety. This is the exact opposite of what John C. Yoo was saying when he says that actually the real safety is is found in subordinating your will to that of the leader. And so that's where we've come now, where we've completely lost our moorings in absolute morality here, the idea that there is one law that everybody is subject to. That's the fundamental claim of equality in the Declaration of Independence. "All men are created equal with respect to the law. In America, the law is king," wrote Thomas Paine in Common Sense. That's the American perspective here. Now, that requires permanent, fixed, absolute morality here. It doesn't mean that we're always going to be moral. You know, we're fallen, sinful people, but it means that there is a standard that doesn't change with the times, and we're all accountable to that. And now we become hostage to the sovereignty of the appetite as abetted by this huge and metastasizing government and cultural organ that is seeking to indoctrinate all of us in the belief that the good life consists of conformity with the dictates of the state, because it is the state that will redistribute to our benefit anything that we really want as long as we go along with the game.
And you know, really, so this goes right along with a book that was written by Manly P. Hall, who was really the founder of the Philosophical Research Institute in Southern California. And of course, and he was a Satanist. And of course, his book, The Secret Destiny of America, is pivotal to understanding what's going on. And everybody should read it. We offer the book, but we do not list it on certainly our website nor in our catalogs. You have to ask for it specifically because we don't want anybody to think we endorse it. But Matthew P. Hall tells us that for 3,000 years there have been secret societies working for this idea of democracy. And what he's really talking about, what he talks about democracy, is exactly what William's talking about, the all-powerful state. Because the purpose of all of these secret societies has always been to create a one-world government and a one-world leader and a one-world religion. With the destruction of Christianity, and any of you who doubt that, you can go to the site of the Lucius Trust, and they offer a series of pamphlets on those three subjects I just mentioned, or we will make them available through our ministry. But they really do intend to destroy Christianity. They really do want the all-powerful government, which eventually will be the one-world government, and they want the coming world leader. This is what people don't understand. It all goes back to Nimrod. This is what Nimrod wanted. He wanted to be that world leader. And, of course, he failed, because, of course, God intervened and all the people were separated. They all began to speak different languages, and they began to babble. The Tower of Babel, of course, was never completed. It is being completed in Europe today as the European Union. In fact, the headquarters of the European Union is a replica, and it's in Strasbourg, Germany, a replica of the unfinished Tower of Babel. They understand exactly what's going on. They certainly expect that we will never understand what's going on until, of course, the final dictatorship is established. We're well on the way to that one-world police state that has been prophesied and sought for so many thousands of years.
Yeah, and it's being built by supposedly conservative hands. It's one of the things that I find just indigestibly ironic. The fact that you have a war in Iraq right now, the advertised reason for which is to enforce the resolutions issued by the United Nations Security Council. That august body, you know, we should be killing and dying on behalf of the United Nations so as to enhance its power and prestige. That's the advertised reason. There are other reasons, of course, that I think are more substantively compelling. The idea, for instance, that a certain group of transnational elites wants to control the oil wealth, the natural gas and natural wealth of that region. They're looking upon this as a way of politically consolidating control over the world gas station. I think that's an obvious thing that's going on right now, and there are other agendas at work here. But when back in March of 2003, George W. Bush was advertising the reasons for this, he said, well, the United Nations has issued this number of Security Council resolutions, and we obviously have to make sure that these are carried out because we want to make sure that the United Nations has adequate power and prestige, and that the Security Council resolutions will not be sent out and returned void. And he had the entire conservative movement bulimically regurgitating that line. I remember vividly listening to that dimwit Sean Hannity in about March or April of that year in, you know, a full head of affected indignation over the idea that we would let these Security Council resolutions be made a nullity through inaction. And I really hadn't known until that time that Mr. Hannity was so enamored of the United Nations and so desirous of seeing that its power and prestige be optimized. But of course, he's just simply reciting the lines that are fed to him by his handlers. And you have the entire conservative movement now talking about the same thing with respect to Iran. I mean, Iran is defying the United Nations. It's defying the will of the world. Well, no, it isn't, because the United Nations doesn't represent the world. Everything about the United Nations is a lie, beginning with the title United Nations. It does not represent the nations of the world. It represents the governments of the world, almost all of which are tyrannies, including our own, increasingly. I mean, it's becoming increasingly obvious that we're dealing with a tyranny, an illegitimate government. That's what the word tyranny means. But in any case, from the very beginning, the United Nations was a consummate fraud, and it's, I think, a pretty good example of what the Tower of Babel would have been like if you would have had simultaneous translation during the construction of the unfinished Tower of Babel. You know, I don't put all that much stock into symbology, but I do think that there are times when symbols do mean something, and you brought up the fact that the iconography of the European Union is absolutely replete with visual allusions to the Tower of Babel in that famous depiction by, I believe the name of the artist was Bruegel, beginning, of course, with the architecture of the headquarters building there in Strasbourg, but also way back in 1992, there was a guide to the building of the European Community, as it was then called, that had in the background the same depiction of that of the unfinished Tower of Babel. That's an architectural style now called a ziggurat, and that was the chosen symbol for the building of the European Community way back in 1992. And they know what they're doing. They obviously are literate, educated men and women. They know the import of the symbolism that they have chosen. They know the import of the architectural style of that headquarters building, and they know that it resonates with this ancient dream of this legendary figure named Nimrod to organize a world government that he would head where everybody would be in subjection to him. And he'd have an order of government that would be structured on overt and unabashed defiance of God's sovereignty. And, of course, as the book of Genesis says, God nixed that plan. He made the nation separate at Babel, and what God has made separate, no man should try to join.
Well, unfortunately, they are trying to join it together, and certainly, barring divine intervention, why they're going to succeed. But our job is to sound the alarm, to stand on the wall, as it's described in Ezekiel 3 and Ezekiel 33. We're the watchmen. William Griggs, a watchman, and I like to think that Radio Liberty is joining him up there on the walls, sounding the trumpet and sounding the alarm. The invaders are here. They're inside the wall. They're intent upon destroying what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. And, well, again, our guest is William Griggs. William, what's your blog site?
Go to http://freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Or, an easy way to do it is to go to rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's one word, rightsourceonline.com. That will lead to the homepage of the Right Source, which is a web portal I help to edit. Look at the left-hand side of the screen, scroll down about a third of the way through the page, you'll find my photograph, and to the right of my photograph there will be two hyperlinks, and the one furthest from my photograph will take you to my blog, Pro Libertate. And once again, the easiest way to find it is to go to rightsourceonline.com.
Well, that's an excellent website, and I really have been enjoying it, especially today. Well, you've got about 2 minutes to wrap up the program.
I do think that one of the really optimistic things we're seeing here, in light of this effort to consolidate political control over the nations of the world in a central location, and that's, of course, once again being done largely by conservative hands right now, unwittingly on the part of the masses, but the people who are directing this know full well what they're doing, I think. But as the effort to consolidate political control is going on, and economic control as well, you have a counter movement that is springing up now in the form primarily of the Ron Paul campaign, which is something we talked about on a couple of occasions. The most remarkable thing about the Ron Paul campaign is that it represents a genuine, spontaneous outpouring from people across all points of the arbitrary political spectrum here on behalf of the concept of liberty under law, the idea of freedom, individual freedom protected by law rather than being regulated by law, the idea of peace as a preferred state of affairs rather than militarism and foreign adventurism, with the understanding, of course, that there may be times when we will have to defend our individual rights and our national independence through force, but it should be done constitutionally. Ron Paul has been very articulate on that point. And the idea of minimizing the role of government in the lives of people. And that's a concept that those three ideas taken together form a composite concept that is incredibly attractive, particularly to young people who are net savvy and technically astute. And the fact that you're having this movement coalesce around this man, who's a very unprepossessing man, who does not at all give the impression that he's impressed with himself, this is a really encouraging development, and it does represent the fact, I think, that that which has been inscribed on our hearts by our Creator is a very potent force when it is allowed to be expressed by people who love freedom. I do think that that does augur a very interesting battle over the next year and a half or so, or next 14 months. But once again, I'm really happy to see that, particularly among the young, you're seeing these people resonating to the message of liberty. That's a very encouraging thing in some very dark times.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, William Greek. William, I'm going to have to let you go, but one more time, please get your website out, how people can get to Pro Libertate.
Okay. Go to rightsourceonline.com.
That's
one word.
Rightsourceonline.com. Right.
And you'll find my blog on the left-hand side of that screen. Scroll down about a third of the way through the page, and you'll find the link for my blog, Pro Libertate.
God bless you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was William Greig, and always a pleasure to have William here. And I think, of course, people have to understand that we are facing a financial crisis, probably with the destruction of the value of the American dollar and the destruction of the savings and pensions and insurance policies and everything, of course, material that most people have, those who have not been listening to our program and taken defensive action. But it may, of course, take something like that to cause people to begin to evaluate what's really important. Are material things important? Is family important? Is freedom important? And hopefully people will begin to understand how we lost our freedom and try to reclaim it while there's still time. Well, that's, of course, why Radio Liberty does what we do 5 hours a day. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family and help us, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, like the virus and war, because America is under attack today. And so we hope that we'll hear from you. We hope you'll be telling others about our program, because people telling people telling people is how we build up an audience all across America, indeed all across the world. And we want to remind you about the special all-day seminar we're having on the 28th of October. It's going to be here in the Monterey area, in the North Shore of Monterey Bay at the Aptos Eastcape Golf Course. We'll start early in the morning. We'll go through late evening. We'll be serving lunch. You're going to have reservations. Again, the number is 1-800-544-8927. How do you understand what William was talking about Nimrod, certainly about this idea of everything centering around government? Well, I suggest a couple of the DVDs we have that take you into the secret societies that have been here, and were here even in Elizabethan times over in England. And that would be The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning by Chris Pinto. It's an excellent DVD. And then, of course, Riddles in Stone. And with Riddles in Stone, you'll certainly want to get that book, and it is available through Radio Liberty, but you have to request it. You have to remember the name, The Secret Destiny of America. The Secret Destiny of America, it's inexpensive, written by Manly P. Hall, who was a Satanist, who really was the leader of the world satanic movement during the last half of the 20th century. He died about 1990, but he was a key individual to an understanding of what's going on, and we do carry his book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, The Lost Keys of Freemasonry. But the book that you'd really need to understand, as Manly P. Hall says, that for 3,000 years, why, there have been secret societies working to bring about world democracy. And of course, what he really means is a world authoritarian system. Why are we fighting in Iraq? Well, one of the reasons is we want to bring democracy to those people. Why would we want to bring them democracy? They did never ask for democracy. We are not a democracy. We're a republic. And if you don't understand the difference between a republic and democracy, we have a little pamphlet called We Are a Republic. Very, very simple, but it gives you the information you need to understand the difference between a republic and, of course, mobocracy, which is another name for democracy, which always results in tyranny. And to understand the foundation of our freedom, we have the four-tape set on the foundations of our freedom. And, of course, we hope that many of you go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and pull down the things that we have there. We have certainly pamphlets on every subject. If you want to understand finances, we have a wonderful talk. It's called the Financial Tsunami. It's a talk, and there's a syllabus that goes with that. If you want to understand the World Revolution, we have a DVD. We have a video on that. We'll soon have a DVD on it. with actually my interview with Earl Sullivan, who was the American ambassador to Cuba at the time. The United States intentionally brought Fidel Castro to power and has kept him in power ever since then. Now, most people think he's the enemy. That's what you're supposed to think, but you've got to learn to think outside the box, to be able to think independently, to understand that most of what you think you know just is not true. We'll be right back in just a moment. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of a man named Rick George. And Rick George belongs to he's a legislator, and is it Montana or Idaho where you're in the legislature, Rick?
Montana, Dr.
Montana. Of course, he is actually was elected by the Constitution Party, so he is certainly a member of a third party in the state legislature, and because of the way the legislature is constructed, half Democrats, half Republicans, he many times is the deciding vote, sort of like Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court, four liberals, four conservatives. And Justice Kennedy is the most important man in America today because he swings the votes of the Supreme Court. If he wants to go one way, that's the way the country goes. So I understand that you're playing at least some part there in the legislature there in Montana, making deciding votes.
That's true, Dr. Monteith. Actually, the count in the House in Montana, we have 100 representatives. The count was 50 Republicans and 49 Democrats and myself. And so, yes, through the session, which is over now, actually, I did have an opportunity to pretty much the deciding vote and on many issues.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, many people say, oh, well, gee, what the third-party candidates, they can't accomplish much of anything, but here, because you've proven that they can, and not only that, but I think there's a tremendous move afoot, or people are becoming disillusioned with both political parties. They're looking for somebody who represents our Constitution, somebody who believes in freedom and is not a political hack, and I think that's why, of course, we're finding at the national level so many people supporting Congressman Ron Paul, who is the only Republican candidate who is against the war and thinks it's unconstitutional, and who certainly wants to get back to the Constitution. Everybody sort of ridicules him, but that's what it's all about, and that's what the Constitution Party is about, isn't it, Rick?
Yes, sir. That's exactly what it's about. And I would mention just quickly, Dr. Monteith, that I did serve in the 90s for three terms as a Republican, and that experience indicated to me that the Republican, and we had large Republican majorities, and certainly there's some good constitutional conservatives in the Republican Party. But overall, I came to the conclusion that the Republican Party was satisfied with just a little bit less socialism and unconstitutional programs than the Democrats.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and we're seeing that certainly at the national level. We're seeing that in so many states across America. Mm-hmm. And we need people, of course, who believe in these principles of limited government and certainly a balanced budget and lower taxes and, of course, strong moral principles, but most of all, adhering to the Constitution of the United States and to the Constitution of the 50 separate states in which people serve. So tell us a little bit about what you're up to now. Are you running for another political office?
Actually, I'm, because of my service in the 90s, I'm actually term limited. We have term limits in Montana, so I can't run for the legislature in 2008. Quite frankly, I'm not sure what I will be doing personally as far as running. I perhaps might run for a statewide office. What we are doing in Montana, just very quickly, that's taken a lot of our efforts and what we're concentrating on, is we're going to run an initiative to establish personhood at conception. I carried a bill in the last session, Dr. Monteith, that did just that. It amended the Montana Constitution, establishing that life, human life, begins at conception. And we didn't get it passed, but we did get a significant number of votes.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Rick George, and talking about what his plans are and what the Constitution Party is going to be doing there in Montana. Certainly, you must have had a fair amount of support from the people to be able to win. Did they run a Republican against you in your district, or was it simply the Democrat running against you? How did it turn come about that you were able to get elected as a candidate of the Constitution Party?
Actually, this was my third run as a Constitution Party candidate, and I would say that the most significant thing that happened was in the 2004 election. It was a three-way race, a Republican, a Democrat, and myself, and I ended up, after a recount, I ended up tying with the Democrat. And long story there, but ultimately that went, and by the way, the balance of the Montana legislature was at stake then also, and the Democrats challenged it all the way to the Montana Supreme Court after the governor appointed me to the seat, and then the Supreme Court overturned the election and placed the Democrat. And so in the 2006 election, the Republicans decided not to run a candidate, so in 2006, this last election, it was just myself and the incumbent Democrat, and I was able to get about 56% of the vote and won that seat at that time.
All right, fine. Well, of course, this is the Constitution Party really has sound principles, and of course, what its major thrust is the American Constitution. You would think that, of course, every candidate would run on the Constitution because they have to swear to uphold it, but so many of them really don't even understand what it is. In fact, I know when they asked our congressman at an open debate how many articles there were in the Constitution, he hesitated, and he said, is that 26? Well, of course, he was thinking of amendments. He didn't know the difference between an article and an amendment. But this is Sam Farr, the Republican congressman who's been here, you know, for I don't know how many terms in the Monterey Bay area. And this is what we have, the problem we're in so much today, is most of our elected representatives swear to uphold a constitution that they've neither read nor understand.
That's absolutely true, Dr. Monteith, and I will tell you from experience that I would say, a guess, I've not done any scientific survey here, but from my experience, I would say a majority of legislators that I have served with have not, if they've read the Constitution.
Well, certainly, Dr. Stan here, we're talking with Rick George, and certainly we were talking about so many of the legislators don't understand the Constitution. And what were you saying, Rick, before we so rudely interrupted you?
Well, so many of them, for sure, have not actually even read the Constitution significantly, and certainly they haven't studied it. I actually had a legislator in a discussion on the floor, a private discussion, admit to me that they had not even read the Constitution. And I suggested to the speaker that, and I knew that was the case in more than just that case, and I appreciate your point about the oath, and I'm convinced personally that many legislators simply do not understand what an oath is. I many times when I served in the legislature in the Republican Party had to remind the Republican Party as they pressured me for a vote on certain issues that I would not vote that way because my oath is to the Constitution, not to the party. And the fact is that we need to make votes based on our oath to the Constitution. In my view, that certainly supersedes any allegiance to a political party.
You know, I really think one of the things that might be well worthwhile doing would be getting through some sort of a state initiative that would require everybody who is a state legislator to spend one weekend a month studying the Constitution and have to be able to pass a test on the Constitution before they could either take their seat or maintain their seat. And it might sound trite, but really we need to train our legislators in it. And this is why, of course, we actually, on a monthly basis, we'll ordinarily have people on our program from the Institute of the Constitution.
Yeah.
Every single month, if we go through the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, again and again and again, and take it back to the Federalist Papers, take it back to the Declaration of Independence, because it is those documents, the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Federalist Papers, which is the foundation of our laws, which is the foundation of our freedom. And isn't it a shame that the wicked people who would take away our freedom have taken the teaching of this out of our schools and out of our churches and certainly out of our universities and out of our law schools. And the vast majority of the people who serve in our legislatures, many who are lawyers, have never even read the Constitution.
Well said, Dr. Monteith. I agree fully, and that certainly is my experience. I'm fully convinced that they absolutely do not understand not only the words of the Constitution, but they don't understand constitutional principles in the sense that the Constitution is representative of a Republican form of government rather than a democracy. And I'm further convinced that in this age of humanism and secularism and moral relativism, that the advocacy of democracy fits very well into their evolutionary presuppositions, and the Constitution they view as a hindrance because it represents absolutes and mostly absolute restraints on what government can do, and that doesn't fit well into their notion of democracy where the majority gets to decide what's ethical or moral or just for that day.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I think it's so important that our listeners out there know the Constitution, understand the Constitution, and then, of course, are prepared to discuss this intelligently with others and introduce them to these concepts,
right,
which are the very foundations of our freedom. Well, do you think you're going to be able to carry this initiative to the state, to the people of the state, you know, to say that life begins with the conception, which, of course, is simply trying to, at the state level, do away with abortion? But the trouble is, Rick, that if you do that and you put your whole heart and soul into it, the federal government will simply declare it unconstitutional.
Well, you're probably exactly right, Doctor, and that again goes right back to a misunderstanding almost universally of the Constitution. Roe versus Wade, of course, is not law. The courts can't make law. Article 1 of the federal Constitution establishes very clearly that all legislative power is vested in the Congress. So this notion that is very frustrating to me, that the court, Roe v. Wade being one example, can make law, really needs to be challenged.
But of course the thing is that the legislature, the ones that make law, and all they had to do, the Republicans control the House, they control the Senate, the presidency for 6 years. All they had to do was pass a legislation by a simple majority saying that, of course, the court had no jurisdiction. An abortion would not be certainly dictated by the federal government. This would be a state issue, and that henceforth the federal courts could not in any way intervene. And certainly, I believe it's Article 2 of the third. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution,
yes, sir.
Would say that the courts cannot intervene, and that would have ended it. But George Bush, of course, pretends that he's a pro-life, but he's really not. He could have done that at any time. He could even put in an executive order saying, the federal courts had no authorization. I'm putting in an executive order, and it would have taken a two-thirds majority to overrule that executive order ending abortion. But neither the president nor the legislature really wanted to do anything, and until they have the courage and the conviction of the importance of human life, that human life is a gift of God, and that every individual is a unique individual made in the image and likeness of God. Until we have legislators who feel that way at the national level, I don't believe anything effective can be done at the state level. So why would you do this? Do you think that you might be able to actually get the people understanding, or could you utilize this as an educational method to make people understand how they've taken away our freedom and our states' rights by judicial edict, and certainly by the ineptitude and this selfishness of our federal legislators, who really, of course, want to have power for themselves and are abrogating their oath of allegiance to the Constitution?
Right, and I think you've basically stated it very well, and I certainly understand the arguments regarding the federal government and the Supreme Court and how they usurp authority from the states. We want to do it, for the most part, because, number one, it's the right thing to do. I think that that one of the great travesties in our nation is the destruction of our unborn children, our innocent unborn children, and the fact that the courts have declared that that's somehow a constitutional right, no less. So we want to do it because it's the right thing to do, but we don't want those innocent babies forgotten, but we also want to take advantage of the opportunity to keep the public debate going, not only on the life issue, but also on reestablishing these constitutional principles where usurpations by the federal government, violations of the 10th Amendment, for example, simply need to be addressed. And I think, quite frankly, Dr. Monteith, you'd mentioned the grassroots support that Dr. Ron Paul is getting in his run for president. I think this is exactly what's happening. We are, I think, across the nation, in my view, experiencing almost an uprising of citizens that understand that something's wrong. They may not be able to articulate it. They might not know exactly what's wrong, but they know something's wrong, and they do have reverence for our Constitution. So I think we need to use these opportunities to do everything we can regarding constitutional education.
And I think that we have to get people to understand that freedom and limitation of government power are inseparable. If we don't limit the power of government, we cannot be free. Liberty and limited government go together. Tyranny and total government go together. And there really are people in the executive branch of government and the judicial branch of government and the legislative branch of government who want all power in Washington, D.C. And that's a frightening thing to contemplate. And where is the outcry, though, from our people? And I just hope it's growing up there. Obviously, you must have a lot of good people up there in Montana. I know we have a lot of good people in Idaho. And what we really need to get is to the people in the large population centers of America, because that's where the bulk of the votes are. Do you think the Constitution Party is going to be able to accomplish that?
Well, my friend Howard Phillip often says, and I think it's a quote from John Adams or John Quincy Adams, that duty belongs to us and results belong to God. And so I think we can accomplish a lot with God's help. I certainly don't want to develop a mindset of despair or hopelessness. So we're going to keep doing what we can do. I think it was Everett Hale that said, I'm only one, but I am one, and I will do what I can do. With God's help, I'll do what I can do. And so I guess that's basically the view that I've tried to adopt.
And I think you're absolutely right. I think this is God's battle. We're called to do our best. We're told to take a stand, and of course, but in the final analysis, the battle is the Lord's.
Right.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 464-8295. If you have a question for Rick George, a very courageous fellow, he's not in the legislature to make money. He has his own job, I understand you. You have a fish farm, is that right?
It is right, Dr. Monteith. I've actually been raising fish since I was about 12 years old. I raise West Slope cutthroat trout. They're the state fish of Montana, and I had a hobby starting out, and it's turned into a business.
Well, I'm glad you actually sell this to people who have fishing streams, or do they sell them to markets, or what do you do?
I sell them live, and virtually 100% go to private fish ponds in Montana, Idaho, Washington.
A fair statement?
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
All right, fine. And so certainly there are members of the Constitution Party then running really all across America. I understand the Constitution Party is now the third largest political party in America.
That's my understanding also as far as registered voters. And I believe we are making an impact. We had a wonderful presidential candidate. You mentioned the Institute on the Constitution. Michael Peruka's law office developed that, and Michael was the presidential candidate for the Constitution Party in 2004, and I thought he did a wonderful job of espousing the principles of constitutional government.
Well, I certainly thought that he did, too. And in fact, we have Michael on once a month, every Friday, I think the second Friday of every month on our afternoon program, because he's always a pleasure, and because he certainly has given so much of himself. And it really finances the Institute of the Constitution largely himself, trying, of course, to rekindle that understanding and that belief in this most amazing document. And the great tragedy is it is so effective and really so marvelous that they have done everything they could to suppress its message and suppress its meaning across America.
Yep.
Well, Rick, of course, what advice would you have for somebody who is thinking of running for office?
I would encourage them, first and foremost. Quite often we talk about going to party meetings, etc. I think one of the most significant things they can do, and this is kind of the route I followed, is before I was ever elected or even became a candidate, I spent as much time as I could in the legislature tracking bills, following bills, if you want to get a feel, for example, if you decide you want to run for the legislature, try to take in the committee meetings. You learn the system, you learn the debate, you learn the decorum, the rules, etc. And when you have that confidence as a candidate, it's very helpful. And so that's one thing I would encourage people to do. And certainly, going back to some of the things you mentioned previously regarding our founding documents, make yourself aware. You know, I became a student of those documents and just read extensively. Read the Constitution, study it. Get the Institute on the Constitution packet and go through that. And when you know, read the Declaration of Independence. It's so vital to understand those, and the Federalist Papers and the discussions and debates that they had, because if you understand those even in an elementary fashion, quite frankly, in my view, you're far ahead of most incumbent office holders in our nation today.
In fact, it was really so interesting. I'm in the process of reading Alan Greenspan's his book, The Age of Turbulence, and he talks about the men who inspired him, and he talks about Adam Smith, who, of course, the whole idea of the free enterprise system and the invisible hand, but then he talks about John Locke. And you really can't understand America unless you understand John Locke, who apparently was quite an inspiration to Alan Greenspan. But Locke lived in the 1600s, but his ideas of nature's God and nature's law, and of the rights of life, liberty, and property, were foundational to the writing of the Declaration of Independence, and those ideas, of course, were expressed by Thomas Jefferson. And yet most people, when they read the Declaration of Independence, don't understand where the ideas came from.
That's right.
And certainly Thomas Jefferson was expressing the views that had been expressed 100 years before a Christian writer, John Locke, who was writing about the right of men to be free. And the ideas of freedom really come from Christianity. For where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And people really don't understand that. They don't understand, you know, John Knox and these ideas that came with the Protestant Reformation. That no longer did we have to look to government and the king, which of course usually validated. The king was validated by the church. Now, of course, the government was not validated by the church. It was founded on Christian principles, but we were not to be a theocracy, we were not to have a monarchy. And what a wonderful idea that all men were created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. The very foundation of our freedom, not taught in schools today. Well, Rick, certainly I think what you're doing is great, and I think what you're doing is so important. And certainly, are there other people up there in the state of Montana who are going to be running for political office there under the auspices of the Constitution Party?
Yes, sir. We're making a significant impact, and it goes back to, you know, whether you win or lose. In my view, if you run and you base your campaign on the Constitution and the principles of freedom, you never lose. And we had over 20 candidates across the state of Montana in the last election, and we're making a significant enough impact that the Republican Party is the contention, of course, being that the Republican Party loses votes to our candidates. They are very aware of the Constitution Party, and they, in my view, especially this election, because quite frankly I've become very close to many sitting legislators, and they are, of course, beginning to recruit candidates for the next election, and they know that if they recruit candidates that really are liberal or more Democrat in their philosophy, that we're going to get a Constitution Party candidate running against them. So even if we don't get candidates elected, we're making an impact on, in essence, keeping the Republican Party honest, I guess I would say.
Because it really is a tragedy. I saw this here in California, where the Republicans were so interested in winning that they backed Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's
yep.
a lifelong Democrat who pretends to be a Republican, and yet, of course, most of the things he supports are the Democratic things. In fact, I was a member of our Central Committee here, the Republican Central Committee, and had been on the State Central Committee for years, and when they came out and backed illegally Arnold Schwarzenegger in the primary against a good, honest-to-goodness conservative, which was against all the rules of the Republican Party, but they wanted to get Arnold in, I just said, I will not put up with this, and I simply left. And I think an awful lot of people are beginning to look and realize that the leaders of the Republican Party are very little different than the leaders of the Democratic Party.
Right.
And certainly, one thing I will say, that here in California, at least, they've held the line somewhat on taxation, but on so many of the moral issues, and the really important issues, why they've gone right along with the Democrats. What we need, of course, are Republicans who will stand on those traditional Republican principles of limiting taxation. And I think what you're doing there, obviously, is you're holding the Republicans' feet to the fire, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Rick is simply pointing out that in Montana there are a large number of people running for office on the Constitution Party, and what they really are doing is they're forcing the Republicans, whether they want to or not, to nominate conservative candidates, because the Republicans know that if they simply come up with a rhino Republican, that means a Republican in name only, rhino. You know, a liberal Republican that the Democrats will, pardon me, the Constitution Party will run a candidate against them, and they're going to lose that seat. And, of course, the one thing, of course, the leaders of the Republican Party don't want is to lose the control, because they want power and all the benefits that come with that. So the Constitution Party is really forcing the Republicans to adhere to Republican principles. Would that be a fair statement, Rick?
Yeah, and I would just make the quick point that that's basically a consequence of what we really want to do. I sincerely believe, and I think most Constitution Party folks do also, that, you know, Americans should have the right and opportunity to vote what they truly believe in. And many Americans truly believe what our founding fathers believed. They believe in the principles of the Declaration of Independence. They believe in limited government. They believe in biblical principles. And I think, quite frankly, Dr. Monteith, that we as a nation, and even in the Christian circles, have embraced the philosophy of pragmatism to such an extent that we've really compromised ourselves. We don't uphold our principles like we should. And so we don't believe there's anything wrong with voting for somebody because they believe truly what you believe in. We're concerned that if we become so pragmatic that we got to vote for the lesser of two evils, that's not taking us. That's what a friend of mine calls slow death Republicans. You know, we're still going to die, but it's going to be a slow death. And we just believe that principles are the basic, fundamental constitutional principles are so important that we need to resist the urge to become pragmatists and stick to principles and vote according to our conscience.
And I think, of course, you vote according to the Constitution. That is what you have to do. And that, mm-hmm. that really, of course, if you adhere to the Constitution, then you don't have to worry and take into account all the various intricacies of a piece of legislation. Is it constitutional? Now, certainly,
yes,
when it gets to the state level, why, you have to adhere to the state constitution as well as the federal constitution. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there and you have a question or comment, you agree or you disagree, would like to know how you out there in the listening audience feel about this idea of a third political party challenging the status quo and the one-party system we have. They call themselves Republicrats but basically where we have two political parties so close together that it really doesn't matter which one you put in, because they're going to do exactly the same thing. The Republicans traditionally have been in favor of limiting the government. Under the Bush administration, and really under the previous Republican administrations, they've given us the largest increase in government programs ever before. We've got the biggest federal deficits. We've got the biggest trade deficits. And that's exactly from the opposite of what the Republican Party stands for. When you had, of course, that terrible Bill Clinton, and he was an immoral individual, and he was, and yet, of course, he was fiscally responsible, and we had the smallest trade deficits and the smallest federal deficits under the wicked Bill Clinton. So what's wrong with this picture? And I think that we ought to be able to take a second look at things and try to decide. I mean, you know, if the Republicans are not going to stand for what they're doing, and you certainly maybe not want to support the Democrats because of their moral position, and they always want to keep raising taxes, and of course, actually, Bill Clinton actually went along with the Republican programs on so many things. Why, of course, yeah, we've got to reevaluate what's going on today, and we need to get people in government who believe in the Constitution. So how are we going to, do you think that things are shaping up there in Montana and the other states you know about?
Well, we're struggling just like every other state, Dr. Monteith, and, you know, across our nation we have an entrenched secular socialistic collectivist mentality, and that's what we've got to work to overcome. And unfortunately, so often it's our own tax dollars that are working against us, but that's the hole we find ourselves in. And so, but I think we've got to keep the fight up. We've got to keep hope, and and continue the battle. I mean, we have days where we feel defeated, and we have days where we gain some members and some interest from people, and the numbers grow, and I think we need to be in it for the long term.
What's the response been to people in your area that here you are running as a member of the Constitution Party, and certainly this is quite an accomplishment, you know, certainly elected to the state legislature, having an impact at the state level many times, I'm sure, being the deciding vote one way or the other. So basically, what's the attitude of the Republicans towards you? What's the attitude of the Democrats towards you?
Well, that's interesting, because when I was first elected, and then, of course, the House being basically tied with me being the deciding vote, boy, there was a lot of articles written that with lots of concern, because obviously when you ask about how people perceive me, well, they look at some of our platform, and in this day and age, it seems extreme and radical and all those other terms that they use. And so I was oftentimes labeled in the media and elsewhere as extreme and radical and many other things, quite frankly. But as I visit with people, and I think, quite frankly, that it took me two elections running on the Constitution Party to overcome that perception, because when I visit with people personally, and you have an opportunity, and in Montana, the House districts are small enough, 9,000 population, something like 4,500, basically about 4,500 voters in a House district, you can hit every door, and you can talk to every voter in that district. And so that helps in my case. And being able to talk to them personally, they begin to hear why you believe what you believe, why you promote what you promote. And I think their apprehension about the notions of extreme and radical are negated to a large extent once they understand the principles. And again, they are generally so ignorant about constitutional principles. When you begin to show it to them and explain it to them, by and large, they begin to understand it and come around. And I think that's why I was able to garner enough votes to win the seat, ultimately.
Well, of course, now, is there any sort of a program up there to educate the public about the Constitution, other than the Institute of the Constitution, or do they have actually any teaching programs going on in your state, in your district, to educate people to an understanding of our Constitution?
We have county groups that that work to some extent. We certainly are working on establishing more county groups. One, just the fact that I was able to get elected and then was so in the thick of things during the session, Dr. Monteith established huge amounts of publicity, media coverage for the Constitution Party here in Montana. During the first half of the session, it was almost every day some kind of an article, either lamenting the fact or at least pointing out the fact that Representative Jor was again the deciding vote or something like that. And so whether it was negative or positive, it was publicity across the state. So I think after this last session, we are as a party, the Constitution Party in Montana, we're known statewide now, so that's been a real help as far as the party perception and coverage in the state.
Well, I think everybody thinks that's exciting, and I think you're sort of the point man for the Constitution Party, and people have to understand that the last thing our founders ever wanted was a two-party system where, of course, we did not have representative government. And we do not have a representative government today. We have two political parties that are usually being bought off by powerful forces and influenced by lobbyists, and what we need are people who represent the public, not people who represent the power structure of the powerful people, who run the state financially. And certainly in almost every state, there are people with big bucks who come along and simply buy up the politicians. We saw that in California, where very powerful people came in and simply bought up, I know, and put in tremendous amounts of money, even in simply the county central committees. I mean, $100,000, $200,000, $500,000. I think they put $100,000 to buy off the, to advertise, you know, running people as conservatives who are not to take over the central committees, really very unimportant positions all across our state. People with a lot of money are the ones who run things. It's about time we had a political system that represented the people, not the special interest groups.
I agree fully. Now, I'm sure you're aware of the quote regarding democracy, that democracy cannot last as a permanent form of government. It can only last until people discover they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury.
Alexander Tyler writes beautiful
yes, sir.
Statement.
Yes, sir. And in my view, that's where we're at. That money does buy favors within government, because we do not understand and we do not enforce, as voters, the principles of constitutional government that limits the functions of government. If we had elected officials that understood that they don't have authority to do certain things, unless it's on the federal level, at least expressed in the Constitution, then that money wouldn't buy those favors.
And we wouldn't be in a war for 6 years in Afghanistan, and four and a half years now in Iraq, and we would not be going to war with Iran, with which maybe millions of people more will die, and certainly the whole of the Muslim world will be turned against us. These things would not be happening if our people in the legislature in Washington, D.C. believed in the Constitution and, of course, enforced it, that says that only the Congress can declare war. This is not a declared war. It is not a real war. It's a make-believe war. Our boys are not being given either enough men or enough equipment or the ability to win this war. They're fighting very bravely with one hand tied behind their back, just like it was in Vietnam.
Yep.
It's Vietnam all over again, and nobody wants to say it. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Rick Jore, that's J-O-R-E, Rick Jore, who's a very brave and courageous fellow who's really willing to put his effort where his beliefs are. It's certainly in many ways a thankless job. This is not a financial a thing that he's doing. He's not getting anything out of it other than the knowledge that he's trying to preserve this country for generations yet unborn. And I think that certainly we're finding all across this country more and more people who are beginning to discover the secret of our Constitution, the foundation of our freedom. And many of these people are getting involved. We just need an awful lot more. How are we going to convince people that they have to be involved, else they're going to lose their freedom?
Dr. Monteith, I would answer that by saying this. Thomas Jefferson said that he asked a rhetorical question, and he said, can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed their only firm foundation, or their only firm basis for these liberties, and that is a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are a gift from God. I would argue, or at least make the point, that we have allowed, and when I say we, I'm talking about the Christian community, our churches that really should know better. We have allowed our nation to become secularized to such an extent. We embrace secularized schools, the government school system. We allow the notions of secular humanism even into our churches, and I think we don't recognize them. And in my view, to really change our nation back, you have to have men of conviction. And convictions can only come from truth. I often say in the legislature that we have some that are conservative by preference, and then we have some that are conservative, and I refer to them as constitutional conservative, by conviction. And in my view, the difference between preference and conviction is convictions are what you will die for. You don't compromise those. And I sincerely believe that we have to understand that as Christians, that from a secular perspective. I'm very frustrated that so often Christians buy into this secularized notion of separation of church and state, for example, without recognizing that civil government is a God-ordained institution, but that all, as Jesus said, that all authority is given to him in heaven and on earth. And so the irony is that the secularists, with their evolutionary presuppositions, really don't even have a foundational basis for civil government or any other authority. Once you displace God or consider the notion a theistic worldview as irrelevant, then on what basis do you establish ethics and therefore justice and law? And I really think Christians need to step in and understand that. I would like to see our preachers raise up like we had, the black-robed regiment, I guess they called them back in the
Revolutionary War.
Yes, sir, the Revolutionary War. And really preach freedom and liberty. I appreciate you saying that where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And it's that internal to external principle, in my view, again. I think we've lost, at least in my experience, in our churches, we just have seemed to lost that. And I think that's where we need to reestablish it, and then it needs to go from there out into our society.
Well, you know that quotation you used about, can the liberties of a nation. Let me just read the entire quotation because I think it's so vitally important.
Okay.
God, who gave us life, gave us liberty.
Okay.
But can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice will not sleep forever. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, of course, when a nation turns against God, then God turns against that nation. And if you're out there in the listening audience, we hope that many of you will determine right now that you're going to get involved in this truly spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. America is the last and only hope for the world. That's why I've stayed here rather than fleeing to other countries like some people have, because I believe that America can be saved. And if America can be saved, the world can be saved. But if America is lost, then, of course, all that we have worked for, we've struggled for, that men have dreamed for down to the ages, will be lost as well. Well, Rick, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. Do you have a web page or anything you'd like to get out to our listeners?
Well, I do. I would actually rather promote the Constitution Party webpage. The national website is www.constitutionparty.com. My website is www.rickjore.com, and I have to admit I haven't updated that for some time. But I would like to mention real quickly, my understanding, Dr. Monteith, is that you have listeners up in the Spokane area, and I'm going to be over there Saturday. And I wanted to put a plug in for the Constitution Party of Washington State. I will be speaking at their state meeting in Spokane, and that meeting is Saturday, October 6th, at the Spokane Valley Mall in the upper level across from Sears, is my understanding. And so individuals that perhaps are listening to this program may want to get over there and learn more about the Constitution Party.
Now, where is that again? What is the location?
It's at the EWU Community Center in the Spokane Valley Mall in Spokane, Washington. And it says here it's in the upper level across from Sears in that mall.
Is there a telephone number or anything people could call if they wanted to find out more details?
Yes, sir. Here it is. 509-928-6910, and that's Bob Peck, the chairman of the Constitution Party of Spokane County.
All right, once you give that telephone number again, you always got to give your number at least twice, sometimes
yes,
three times on radio. Don't feel bad about it, Chris. This is one thing I always insist on, because I know very often when I'm trying to get a number down, I never have a pen in my hand. So let's get that number twice more for you.
I understand that. 509 is the area code, 928 6910. 509 area code 928-6910, and that's for Bob Peck, who's the chairman of the Spokane County Party there.
All right, fine. And Sister Sydney, if you're interested in the Constitution Party, why, here you'll have a chance to meet and talk to Rick Jor, who's actually, of course, on the state legislature in the state of Montana. How does it come that your term limited if you've only been there one term as a Democrat? Are they counting your previous terms as a Republican?
Yes, sir, yeah. The wording is 8 years in any 16-year period, and so my terms during the 90s as a Republican count along with this current term, Dr. Monteith.
Well, God bless you for everything you do. Thanks very much for being with us, Rick. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your program and your work.
Bye-bye. God bless.
God bless you.
All right, fine. Well, that was certainly Rick Jor, and of course Rick Jor is going to be there in actually in Spokane. He's going to be speaking on Sydney on October 6th. I guess that's his coming Saturday. And if you need more information, why, of course, you could hold of Mr. Peck there, who's the chairman of the Constitution Party in the Spokane area. So certainly we recommend that. If you would like to know more about the Constitution Party, you can go to their website, or if you didn't get the number that Rick had put out, you can always call our number. We'll get it for you. Our number, of course, as you know, is 1-800-544-8927. We do not endorse a political party. We simply give you the opportunity to hear what they have to say and decide for yourself what you believe is important. But is freedom worth fighting for? Is freedom worthwhile sacrificing for? I think it is, because I will tell you, we are on the verge of losing our freedom. The people on the other side have been planning for hundreds of years for the time we are approaching now as we move away from freedom towards a one-world government, a one-world religion, and a one-world ruler. And, of course, we hope that many of you out there in the listening audience will give serious consideration to coming to our Saturday conference. It's on the October the 28th. That's about 4 weeks from now, October the 28th. It's going to be held at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and we do hope that many of you will be there. And, of course, we're going to bring in speakers from across the nation. Going to be a great time had by all. So if you can possibly make it, why, you're going to have reservations. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and there's going to be a great lineup of speakers. Start early in the morning, go until late in the evening, or at least until about 5:30. So if you're interested in coming, why, don't put off getting a reservation in, because we have to know how many are coming. We're serving lunch. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, let me recommend it to you. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you don't know the difference between a republic and a democracy, and why our founding fathers did not create a democracy in America, and everybody who, of course, tells you we're a democracy is simply lying to you, and it's not a matter of semantics, it's a matter of confabulation. Our telephone number, if you'd like to get the We Are a Republic pamphlet, is the same we've talked about, 1-800-544-8927. During the last hour, we talked to William Grigg, and we were talking about the unfinished Tower of Babel. And, of course, there is a very, very famous painting in the 1500s that depicts the unfinished Tower of Babel. And that is, of course, on the cover of our talk. It's a DVD available called The Forbidden Secret. And it tells you what that forbidden secret is that was passed down from the time of the Tower of Babel. And, of course, at the time of Nimrod, there was a secret, and it has been known to only a select few. It's been passed down to the intellectuals, through the leaders of the world, and many of the key people down through history have known the secret. But, of course, they never would tell it to the common people like you and me. So if you'd like to know what the forbidden secret is, the talk, I think you'll find fascinating. And, of course, there on the cover you'll see the picture of the unfinished Tower of Babel on the back. You'll see the picture of the replica there in Strasbourg, Germany, of an unfinished building. the unfinished Tower of Babel, which is represents the headquarters of the European Parliament. And this, of course, is all unfolding before our eyes as we move towards a North American Union, a South American Union, a European Union, an African Union, an Asian Union. There is a master plan devised by the people from the dark side to transform the world and carry out the ancient goal of Nimrod to bring about a one world government. God intervened at that time. Will he intervene again? Well, I think it's going to be up to you and me. Would we be worthy of his intervention? Are we, of course, be worthy of his blocking what is planned, been planned for thousands of years? Our number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
Tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.